Be turning in your Bibles to the fourth chapter of the book of Esther. I have told you from time to time that I like this book because it's told more or less in story form. It's almost like watching a series, I guess, on TV, or reading chapters in a book that someone has written on a trip of a pioneer, say, out across the desert, or the wagon trains in the days of the early West. This happened a long time before any of our more contemporary history occurred, but it is an exciting book. It does not bore one. It is very exciting all the way from start to finish. And it's a book that is fully packed with action. And there's more action in the lesson tonight. It's certainly not one of the dry books of the Bible that sometimes people speak of. As far as I know, I've never found any dry book of the Bible. I like books almost of all kinds, especially the books of the Bible. But we're still looking at some events that happened in the life of Mordecai and Esther the queen. Other people concerned in the narrative are Haman, who is the enemy of the Jews, and Xerxes, who is the king of Persia at this time. But we'll see another man coming on the scene in this particular lesson, Hatak, who is evidently one of the chief eunuchs over the harem where the queen stays. But so far, the characters have been very few that have been mentioned. The primary characters throughout the book are Mordecai and Esther. And they're certainly to be seen in the lesson here tonight. Beginning in the fourth chapter, looking all the way down to verse 4, we see how that the Jews lament this bloody edict that has been signed by Xerxes, the king of Persia. I can't help but remember how that in the last verse of the third chapter, whenever that decree went forth, the people throughout all the provinces were perplexed. That is to say, they didn't know exactly what was about to happen. And if they did understand, they were disturbed over what would be soon to happen. And during all of the time of this bloody edict, Haman and the king are getting drunk. I assume to appease their conscience in light of the bloody deed that will be performed before long. I suppose that Haman wanted to keep the king drunk so he wouldn't have time to think about all the people that would die because of this edict that had been signed. And perhaps he stayed so drunk that he wasn't able to go visit the queen very often either, as we're going to see in this lesson. He was keeping him drunk evidently for a number of reasons. Now there's one question that I can't answer for sure that I would like to know the answer for. And that is, did Haman know that Esther was a Jew? Now, he knew that Mordecai was. The king didn't know it at this time. We know that from what's said in chapter 7, later to come. But did Haman know? I don't know. I've just wondered. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe it'll come out a little plainer elsewhere in the book. I don't recall now. But I just wonder at this point if he knew or had any inkling that the queen was of this despised race of the Jews. Well, we're going to see what will happen later. Now, in the first two verses, we're told how that Mordecai cried very bitterly at the king's gate, showing his distress over this awful decree that has been signed that concerns the destruction of his nation. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, how Haman had had the king to sign this edict in order to get rid of him and all the Jews, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and a bitter cry. I would assume that that would be a cry that people could hear. The Jews have always been known as a people that were inclined to mourn. There's an old saying in history, the weeping Jew. The weeping Jew. And even our Savior that was a Jew was known as the man of sorrow, according to Isaiah chapter 53. So it was a custom in that day for the Persians and for the Jews, when they were greatly distressed, to take off their regular clothing and to put on sackcloth and to throw ashes on top of their head. And that was a sign that they were weeping and grieving over some bitter event that was about to take place. So Mordecai is not only crying loud so everybody can hear him with the ears, he is wearing the attire of a mourner. And whenever he goes about the streets, they look upon him as a mourning Jew that is weeping and wailing because of what is about to befall his people. Now it goes on to say in verse 2, and came even before the king's gate. Did he hope to see the king going in and out the gate, maybe have a chance to say a word to him? Well, I don't know. But evidently it wouldn't have been very apt that he would from what follows there. For none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. So what was that? Evidently it tells me that the only ones that could have access to the king were those that were in a good frame of mind. He did not allow anybody to come into his presence that was emotionally disturbed. It was considered in that day an evil omen for one to come into the court of the king in a state of mourning. And so therefore they were all banished from the presence of the king. So as long as Mordecai was a mourning Jew, there was no possibility that he would ever be admitted to the presence of the king. And after all, had he been admitted to the presence of a drunken king, what good would it have done? So he stood there weeping at the gate of the king. You know, Jesus told us in Matthew 11 and 8 that those that are in palaces with kings wear soft raiment and they speak soft words. So the presence of a king was no place for a mourning Jew. So his presence was banished. Now, I don't know how Mordecai must have felt this time. I've tried to put myself in his place. I've tried to sympathize with his situation. Did he at this point regret not having bowed down to Haman, the high officer of the government? Was his conscience maybe not a bit perplexed? Was it possible that there were some misapprehensions upon his mind? Maybe he said, while I did right, it seems that it turned out wrong. Have you ever had that happen to you? I have. He said, I was doing what God told me to do in the book of Deuteronomy, but it seems like that I'm going to get myself killed and all of my people. What a terrible crime I've committed. By failing to bow to Haman, not only will I suffer the consequence of my crime against the state, but all of my people will be put to death. So I don't know. Maybe he said, I ought to have bowed to the old fellow. I don't know how I felt, but knowing the type of man he was, I feel like that he was still trusting God, and he was saying, go or come what may, I believe that I've done right. Somehow, some way, God will vindicate me in my conduct and will spare my nation. And that he believed that comes out in what follows here. And so it goes on to tell us how in the third verse that wherever the Jews heard about this edict, that there was great mourning, there was fasting and weeping and wailing and the like. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews. Doesn't say anybody else mourned. After all, they weren't going to be killed. It's the Jews. There was great mourning among the Jews and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. I'm not exactly sure what may be meant there by laying in sackcloth and ashes, We know that they had that on during the day, but from the way that it reads, I would assume that they went to bed that way, and they got up that way, so that when they were up or when they were down, when it was day or when it was night, they were still mourning, they were still in sackcloth and ashes. After all, if you only had a few months to live, I don't suppose you could sleep as soundly at night as you might want to. So they were staying awake and they were mourning day and night, it would seem, from what follows there. Now somebody might say, well, if I were Esther, if I were the queen of Persia, I wouldn't worry about all these other Jews getting killed, because surely they won't kill the queen. Well, she didn't look at it that way, neither did Mordecai. As a matter of fact, she felt like that the danger that was about to come upon her people was her danger also. Because look at what's said in verse 4. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Now all these Jews are weeping everywhere, day and night, in sackcloth and ashes. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved. She was going to weep with them that weep. And she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. You see, there wasn't too good a means of communication there between Esther the queen and her cousin Mordecai. In that day, you just didn't run up and suddenly go into the presence of the queen or the king. It would mean death. And so about the only way you could communicate was with the maids or the chamberlains or somebody that had access to the harem that would go in and out from time to time. And so I suppose that these messengers told the queen, said, don't you know that Mordecai is standing out there at the king's gate and he's weeping and he's mourning, he's got on sackcloth, he won't even take it off. Day in and day out, he's dressed that way. I don't know, maybe she said, poor old fellow, maybe he doesn't have anything to wear, maybe I better send him some clothes. So she sent him some clothes that would not be sackcloth and all of this, but he said there in verse 4 that he didn't receive it. He didn't want it. He wanted her to know why he was weeping. And evidently at this time, she doesn't have all the details that she will have in the next few moments. So here was a woman that was a queen, but she did not forget her relationship to her people. Also, she did not forget her relationship to Mordecai that had brought her up as his own daughter. And so, evidently, some of the members of the household, the maids and the chamberlains, they already know that Mordecai is her cousin, that he's a Jew, that he's her relative. They have probably learned that from the queen. I would assume that they know from what follows here that there was a connection between Mordecai and Esther. And so down in verse 5 to 7, Esther sends to find out what's wrong with Mordecai. Why is he wearing this sackcloth? Why is he weeping and mourning all the time? Then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. Now, if her cousin is all upset, she wants to know why, and she wants to know what the trouble is. Why is he wearing these sackcloth? And so the means of communication was difficult, so she sends it by the chamberlain that has been appointed to take care of her, the queen. He was probably a eunuch and an old man, if it was according to the custom of that day. But he was highly trusted by the king, and evidently was well trusted by the queen also, because there was a close contact between them, as we'll see. So he is a faithful servant, and he tells Mordecai the message there as we go further. So Hatak went forth to Mordecai under the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews, to destroy them. So here, Hatak is told all of the problem. How that Haman has invented this conspiracy to bring about the Holocaust of all the Jews throughout all the provinces. All because that he would not bow to it. Due to the fact that he was a member of an accursed race to his nation of Israel. And then we go on down to see how that Mordecai makes a plea for Esther to intercede with the queen in behalf of her people. And so we go further now down to verse 8 and 9. And he gave him the copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them. I don't know, maybe Mordecai had something to do with making out those decrees, being a high official in the government. Anyway, he had access to a copy of them. He'd either transcribed it or written it down. Somehow he'd gotten a hold of one, taken it right out of the palace, had it right straight from the source, to show it unto Esther. I would assume from that the ladies in that day didn't know as much about politics as they do now. So Esther did not know much about what had happened so far. She lived a rather secluded life as the queen, and declared unto her and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make requests before him for her people. So her cousin Mordecai says, "You are our only hope. You must go into the very presence of the king as a queen, and you must make supplication, you must intercede, you must plead in behalf of your people and get this cruel edict reversed or abrogated somehow." Well, that sounds like a reasonable request to make. Everybody's about to be killed and she's about the only hope of salvation. So I would say that Mordecai was really giving a very fair request there. And so the messenger is faithful. And Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. So now the queen knows what the problem is. She realizes that her people are soon to be destroyed. But she objects to this going into the royal presence of the king unbidden. In that day, for even the queen to go charging in into the presence of the king could very well mean death, even for her. And so she objects to this going in all of a sudden like. She said, I won't even get to plea. I won't even get to state my case. If he doesn't raise that scepter the right way, they'll kill me as soon as I go in the room. And so she begins to give some objections about doing what Mordecai has asked her to do. And so there in verse 10 to 12, we see how she's making this objection. Again, Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. Now the messenger is going back. They're not in direct communication. I suppose that's about the nearest to the telephone they had in that day, or telegraph, or whatever you want to call it. All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. So she said, "You have made an impossible request. If I even attempt to carry out your commands, I will immediately be killed on the spot. And then I will not be able in any way to help my people, the Israelites." Well, now from the human standpoint, it looks like that her objection was pretty well based. I mean, this was the law of the land, and she could very well get herself killed. So she brings out the fact that, don't you know, that all the people all over the provinces said they know this custom, that it's inflexible justice when you come in. If you're not bidden, that you're going to be killed. So everybody understood that. And she said, least of all, I certainly understand it. Now, why did they have a law like that? I wondered about that as I studied the matter today. I suppose that it was a means of protection to the king to some degree. He kept a lot of these fellows that you don't like to fool with from coming in and bothering the king. And it also got rid of a lot of fellows that probably didn't really have any business with the king that would have just liked to come in there and to see what's going on, like, you know. So I can imagine that the law had some possible advantage there. It did protect the king, and it kept a lot of busybodies out of his presence, and probably kept a lot of would-be assassins out of his presence. But you know, it may have had some other implications. All of these concubines nearby, might be that he didn't want his wife just to come charging in at any time, you know. It might be somewhat inopportune at times. So in order for him to enjoy his harem as he would like, he would not want the queen coming in to bother him unless he told her she could come at the right time, I'm sure. So whatever the reason may have been, I can't say. But looking at it overall, I would say that it was a very bad law. It was not a good law at all. You say, well, now, why would you say that? Well, it would seem to me that it made the royal palace almost into a royal prison, because hardly anybody could come in and see the king. All the business had to be transacted by the ministers of state. In other words, you couldn't just come up and say, well, now I want to talk to the king about a problem. You'd have to go through an intercessor or a minister of state. Well, that's pretty much the way it still is in our country. We can't just go charging in to the President of the United States and say, now look, we'd like to tell you about a problem we got over in the state of Ohio or West Virginia or Kentucky. We just can't do that. We have to go through channels. We have to go through various people. And most of the time we get so weighed down with going through all of the red tape until we might even give up. I don't know whether you've ever tried to get into a government office or not. I tried to get them on the phone and talk to them, but I'll tell you what will happen if you do. Every time that you call, they'll say it's not their department. They'll send you all the way around back to the first fellow you talked to, and he still doesn't know whose department it is. Now, I've had that to happen. That's not exaggeration. That's facts. So evidently, whatever business has got to be transacted, it's always the other department. I don't reckon any department has any business, based on my experience with some of them. But anyway, that's pretty much the way it was then. You could not directly apply to the king for any grievance in his kingdom. You had to go through these ministers of state. So it was a bad thing because you couldn't talk directly to the king. You know, I've always liked the country of Switzerland. The man who is their president cannot leave the country on any trip during his term in office. And if you want to talk to him, you get on the telephone and call him up and you can talk to him. I really think that's a pretty good form of government when you think about it. Direct access to the presence of the chief ruler. Well, they didn't have that in this day, that's for sure. And I believe it's a pretty bad law for the queen. She couldn't even go see the king unless he told her to come. She was just about like imprisoned in the palace. She couldn't even see her own cousin, Mordecai. Couldn't see her friend. So you're just about a prisoner. So I'd say it was a very bad law in the main for the queen, for the subjects, and even for the king himself. But you know, as I read this, I thank God that it's not so with the presence of the King of Kings. According to the book of Hebrews, chapter 4, we can come boldly into his presence and ask for grace and mercy to help in time of need. We don't have to have anybody to intercede for us. We can boldly approach God's presence on the merits of the blood of Jesus. So while you might not have been able to get in to see King Xerxes, and you may not be able to get in to see the President of the United States, you can go into the presence of the King of Kings anytime you want to. You can come boldly, and you don't need anybody on this earth to help you in that respect. Well, I don't know. I suppose Esther at this time is somewhat alarmed and disturbed. She really does want to help her people. I believe that. And she really would like to do what Mordecai has suggested. But she feels like that it will endanger her own life and destroy all possibility of helping her people. And what's God going to do? He's going to test her faith. He's going to see how much courage she's got and whether or not she really believes that God is able to take care of His people. And after all, the circumstance couldn't be worse. She said, I'm just not so sure that I may not be divorced like Vashti pretty soon. Said, I haven't even seen the old boy for 30 days. I suppose he's entertaining himself with the other ladies in the harem. I've not seen him for a month. I suppose that his affections for me are pretty well alienated. And to go in at a time like this would be certain death. Well, if you're going to look at it from the logical standpoint, there was absolutely no reason for her to go. But you know, faith is not always logical. And courage is not always logical. And this lady is going to have great courage. So the message goes forth again in verse 12, and they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Somebody said, well, I guess the old boy said we might as well give it up. She's just not going to be any help. We've told her and we've told her and I've pled and I've pled and it seems like to no avail. This is the second message I've already sent. Must I even now send the third? The answer is yes. And I'll tell you what, the last message was rather strong, even for Mordecai. But I'll tell you one thing, it was the truth. And it was what Esther needed to consider. So he sends the final message to Esther, beginning there in verse 13 to 14. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. He's more or less saying, now just because you're the queen and just because you're in the palace, that doesn't mean you're going to escape that bloody edict. You're going to die like the rest of us. And if that thing is not changed, we're all going to die. So you better wake up. In other words, if you go into the presence of the king, you may get killed. But if you don't, though, you're still going to get killed. So it's just a matter of whether or not you want to get killed going into the presence of the king trying to do right or not do anything and still die. So that's what he's telling her there to me. And then he makes, I think, one of the greatest statements that any man could have made to anyone ever in the Bible. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, it's a time of great extremity, time of great danger to your people, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Boy, I tell you, that's a good text. I've preached from it over the years, and I'll preach from it again because it's a great text. I tell you what, there's strong language of faith in the words of Mordecai. He believed that God somehow would preserve the nation of Israel. After all, the Messiah hasn't been born yet. That was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to others. So he doesn't believe that all the Jews are going to be exterminated. So there is the language of strong faith. Even though the danger is most threatening at this particular time. After all, instruments may fail, but God's covenant will never fail. So he was putting his faith in the promise of God, and he didn't really care what Haman had got passed in the royal court of Persia. So he's making it very plain here that the Jews will somehow be spared. But if Esther does not take advantage of this opportunity of service, then divine vengeance will come after her and her father's house and bring about their destruction. You know, really, that's a very great warning to God's people. if the Lord has brought us to the kingdom for such a time as this, if he has opened the door of service, and we do not pass in through that door, if we do not would do that work that he has given us, then divine vengeance will destroy us. But God's purpose, God's counsel will stand. He'll raise somebody else up to do it. You want me to make it a little plainer and a little stronger? If the Baptists won't preach the truth, then God will raise up somebody else to do it. And if you and I won't do what we ought to do as God's servants, the Lord's counsel will stand and his pleasure will be done. He may destroy us and put somebody in our place. That's something to think about. After all, he said, don't you realize, Esther, that God has put you in as a queen that you might do exactly what I'm telling you to do right now? Why do you think God allowed you to be the queen? A little orphan girl, a foreigner, a captive. Why is it that God allowed you to be the queen instead of Vashti? It's to do what I'm telling you to do right now. This is your time of opportunity. Don't neglect it. But I'll tell you something tonight. God has placed all of us in some position that we may serve him. Maybe your father. Maybe your mother. Maybe you work on a job. Maybe you have some other opportunity of service from time to time. So God has put all of us in places where we may serve him. We're not in that position that we may be seen or talked about or admired or envied, but we are there to do what providence has appointed us to do. Nobody can do the work that God has marked out for you. Everybody has a job. Everybody has a work to perform. Everybody has come to the kingdom for such a time as this. I'll tell you one thing, in the case of Esther, it would be better to perish for a good cause instead of a bad cause. She had that choice. She could perish for a good cause, or she could perish for a bad cause. But death was staring in the face regardless. Well, here was a woman that was equal to the opportunity that she had. She had the faith. She had the courage. She had the determination. She had the intestinal fortitude to stand up and be counted. She was willing to lay all upon the altar of sacrifice. She was willing to pay the uttermost farthing, to go the second mile, to do whatever was necessary that her people might be spared from this awful, bloody edict. So she's going to be equal to her opportunity, and I would to God that all of us could do the same. Verse 15 to 17, and we'll conclude our lesson. Then Esther bade them return to Mordecai this answer. I can see the old man just stands out there weeping, just can't wait to see what she's going to say. He must have kind of smiled and sort of wiped a tear from his eye when he got the message, too. It's just what he wanted to hear. Made the old man's heart leap with joy, I'm sure. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. Be pretty hard for some of us, wouldn't it? I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. That woman had faith. She had courage. She was a queen that was worthy of her office. Not all of them were in history. But here was one of the greatest queens that Persia ever had. My, what great truths I can see here. It doesn't say that they prayed, but knowing the Jews, knowing how that fasting and praying went together, I'm sure that they fasted and they prayed, because fasting was looked upon as a preliminary part of earnest prayer to God. Now note something else about this. She said, you fast and you pray, and I'll fast and I'll pray. Whenever we ask somebody else to pray for us, we better remember to pray for ourselves. That's right. Don't you ask somebody else to do what you won't do. I don't know. I wonder about these maids. Were they of the descendants of Judah? Were they Jews? Or had she converted these heathen maids that had been her keepers? You know, Joseph had a great influence on the keeper of the prison. And what I see here is that maybe they had been real Persians. They were heathens. And this queen had witnessed to them. She had prayed for them, and they were converted to her faith. I tell you, when we are constantly in the presence of people, we ought to do what we can to bring them to the knowledge of our God and our Savior. And if we don't, we have failed in our having come to the kingdom for such a time as this. This woman had done well. What a queen. What a queen she was. Well, it was not possible for her to come out there. Maybe they had a synagogue in Persia. There were many Jews there in Shushan. It wasn't possible for her to come out there to the synagogue, probably with the others, and meet for prayer and fasting, or in the homes or wherever they gathered. Because it was not permissible for the queen to go out into the general public like that. And so she was more or less saying, while I can't bring my presence there with you, I'll be there in spirit, because when you're praying, when you're fasting, we'll be doing the same in the palace where I stay. Well, I believe when we're not physically able to go to the house of God, we ought to be there in spirit. And our hearts ought to be there if our bodies are not. Sometimes I think that's probably taken too far. It is a true saying what I've said. But I've known a lot of people to miss church for the most trivial reasons. They say, well, Pastor, well, I wasn't able to be there. But won't you know that I was there in spirit? One preacher got tired of hearing that, and he felt like the excuses were not very valid. And he told one of the fellows that told him that one time, said, yes, said, I thought there was something wrong at church. Said, I guess that's the trouble. Said, I've been preaching to a bunch of spirits. And said, I noticed when the offering plate went around that your spirit didn't put any money in either. So I guess he got tired of listening to all of that ghost stuff that he was being told about his members. But it is a true saying that if we can't be there due to circumstance, we surely ought to be there in spirit. It seems to me as if Esther's saying at this point, like the Apostle Paul did, I don't count my life dear unto myself. I am willing to risk my life for the good of my people. I'm going to trust my case in the hands of God, whether I live or whether I die. Do you remember three other people that just as good as said that? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They told them to bow down to the golden idol. They wouldn't do it. They took them before the king, and he said, if you don't bow down, we're going to throw you in the furnace, and you're going to burn up. They told the king, said, our God could deliver us from that furnace. Said, we don't know whether he's going to or not. But said, let me tell you something. That it doesn't matter whether he delivers us or whether we burn. We will not bow down to that God. So they had a hard back and they had a hard knee. And they said it doesn't matter whether God delivers us or not. We're going to do what's right. Well, I think that's the way Esther and Mordecai felt at this time. And so she said, I'm going to leave myself entirely in the hands of God. It would be better for me to do my duty and to die for my people than to shrink from my duty and die in disobedience to my Lord. So she said, I'm going to go in to the presence of the king. It was a very bold step. But after all, if you venture nothing, you'll gain nothing. She said, well, the law was against what she was about to do. She realized that there was a lawgiver in heaven and that he controlled the heart of the king. I was thinking today about that great passage in Proverbs 21 and verse 1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. I believe that Esther took that verse seriously. She was about to try it. It had better be so. And so quickly in verse 17, so Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Just two other things as I conclude this message. This feller Hatak, there's not a whole lot said about him. But you know, the world needs a lot of people like him. He was a faithful servant. He did what he was told by Mordecai and by Esther. Have you ever thought about the people in the Bible that there's not much said about that were really very important in God's dealing with his people? Well, Hatak, here in the case of Esther. What about Abraham? Did he not have Eliezer of Damascus? What about Sarah? Did she not have Deborah? Did Naaman's wife not have the little maid from Israel to tell her husband how to be healed of leprosy? Did Moses not have Aaron and Hur to hold up his hands during the battle? And we could go on. The Bible is full of accounts like that. Abraham, Moses, all these people, they had, as it were, second in command. Obedient servants, good friends. Even King Saul had his armor bearer. Well, the world would not go on. The world would not be what it is if it were not for some of these faithful servants. How many places of business would go out of business if it were not for some of the devoted employees that a lot of times do the real work that the boss man may not do? I know a lot of times, a lot of people here, maybe you in the church realize it more and more, that a lot of the work that goes on here, I do very little of it in comparison. I do quite a bit of it. In a measure, I see that it's well done, but somebody else has to do the actual work in a lot of cases. I'm just the overseer. So sometime maybe you need to look at those that help me, because they too play an important role. And do not forget the two ministers of God that this church has that helps your pastor out in filling the pulpit when he is absent for reasons of meetings and conferences and the like. So everybody is important. Everybody has a place to fill. And I wouldn't want to live in a world where you didn't have people like Hatak and Eliezer and Aaron and Hur and all of these others that I've mentioned. And then last and surely not least, every life that is lived in this world has a crucial moment. We'll call it the breaking point. We'll call it the darkest hours of our existence in this world. There is always a critical time that will sorely try us, and after that trial will greatly contribute to the development of our Christian character in this world. How many times it's happened to me. And so whenever that time comes, when we come to the kingdom for such a time as this, let us lay our all on the altar and say, if I perish, I perish. After all, Jesus said, if you lose your life for my sake in the gospel, you'll find it. And if you go out and you waste your life and live it for profit and pleasure, you live it for selfish reasons, then you'll lose it. You'll have nothing to look forward to in the future. Well, here was a woman that said, I'm going to do the will of God no matter what. If it gets me killed, then I'm going to die. And said, if I don't get killed, then I'm going to plead for my people and try to get this edict reversed. But we need a lot of people like Esther, and like Mordecai, that'll stand up and do what's right no matter what the consequence is. You know, a lot of times people see what they ought to do and they say, well, the consequence is a terrible thing. We ought not to do it. It's a terrible tab to pick up. I tell you what, disobedience is far worse. There's far more to bring a curse to God's people by disobeying than there ever is by obeying. After all, hadn't you rather go down with your boots on, go down fighting for what's right, than to go down a living coward? It wouldn't take a stand for the truth. Wouldn't it be better to die for what you believe in than to die for no cause at all? To die a coward? To die in disobedience to the Lord? Well, this is a great lesson on this particular point. Let us stand and we'll have our closing prayer.